Download the Vibes. Welcome back to another episode of the Hoop Genius podcast, brought to you by NBA 2K26. As always, I am Mo Muncy, and alongside me, the legendary coach Brendan Sir. And today we are bringing you another conversation with a very, very special guest. This is a man who's refereed over 1,700 games in the NBA, hundreds of playoffs games, finals games, all-star games, you name it, he's been there, he's seen it, he's done it all. Mr. Bob Delaney, welcome to the show, sir.
Thanks, Mo. Good to be with you and Brendan.
It's an honor. I believe you guys go way back, all the way back to college ball in New Jersey.
Yeah, we played against each other for 4 years in college, and we then went on our paths. I got into college coaching right away. Bob, I couldn't find him for a while. He was an undercover state trooper in New Jersey doing what we'll let him talk about later. But when he came into the NBA 8 years after I got in the league, he quickly became one that when you saw him come on the court, you knew you were going to get a great game, a fair game. And that's all you ever wanted. And someone that I think, Bob, it's really important when you talk, you know, you know, done everything in officiating and even to the point of, you know, you're still supervising and developing referees. What makes up a good referee?
Yeah, I think it's good common sense and very similar to what I did in law enforcement. You know, I would always say that, yeah, the laws are written and there's our rules, but nobody wants a ticket for going 56 miles an hour in a 55 mile an hour zone. Not even 57. So understanding the gray area, what is illegal, what's legal with actions on the floor. And yet there's some plays that are just in that gray area. The really good officials understand how to referee the gray area and also to interact with folks, right? Understand, if you need affirmation, you're in the wrong business if you're going to be a referee. No one's going to stop the game and say, hey, I just want to tell you what a great job you're doing out here. What you have to learn how to do is to navigate the will to win. The will to win at the NBA level, high level, in any sports. I don't care if it's a little kid's game. The will to win is so powerful. And that's what comes at referees. You have to learn how to navigate the will to win. When a referee understands how to navigate that will to win, he or she becomes more mature in their officiating abilities. How do you calm the waters? If a coach is upset, how do you calm the situation rather than put fuel on the fire? Those are the skills that have to be developed. So the programs that I've been involved with from day one in officiating in the NBA has always been about not only getting plays right, but how do you interact with coaches and players and your fellow referees? You're a team out there. There's three teams that compete every game. The two competing and the referee team. We have to be as good a team as the teams that we're officiating.
You know, what I love about social media and the internet now is that you get an insight into what everyone thinks. So say I'm watching a game and I'm watching Lakers versus Warriors. The Lakers fans are convinced that the referees are working against them. Mm-hmm. And the Warriors fans are convinced that the referees are working against them. Now, you retired from refereeing, so you probably don't have to deal with a lot of the kind of online noise. But when you were refereeing NBA games, especially those important playoff and final games, how did you block out the noise of, you know, what fans and teams and media all said about the job that you guys were doing and remained purely objective? Because I can imagine that as a referee, if it is more of a one-sided game, right? Say one side is getting to the line a whole lot more because maybe they're driving the basketball more, maybe they're being more physical. How do you navigate that and not let it impact you and not have those thoughts of, well, I can't give them too many free throws because otherwise they're going to say that I'm supporting this team?
Yeah, it's a great point. I mean, the conspiracy theories run wild. I was a referee on the floor for 25 years. I was in management for the NBA. 5 years during that time, I was the director of officials and vice president of referee operations. We were constantly trying to figure out how do we make sure that there's not a bias that takes place that you just described, right? There can be a tendency. I used to be like, as a young referee, I would answer that question, no, that never takes place. And then as you mature, you just come to realize we're still human beings. And if the game is like way out of some team's beating up another team by 25, 30 points, there may be a tendency there may be a bias as a human being to say, well, I don't want to bury this team. I don't want to call. But you know what was amazing back in the day? Chuck Daly said this to me one time. The Pistons were losing, and they didn't lose often, but they were losing. And he said, my horses aren't going to run tonight. You don't call any fouls. I'm not calling timeouts. Let's get out of here. And, you know, that was a difference back in those days.
Right.
And that was the first time I ever heard that as a referee. I mean, Chuck was, an iconic figure. Brendan knows he was with them all the time. It's just like Chuck had an aura about him. And when he said that, that was a common sense approach to the game. We've gotten away from that. There's so many reasons that we've gotten away from that. And it's just a reality. Life changes, right? I mean, I used to get off of a plane and look for a phone booth. Today, I got a phone in my pocket. You got to adjust. You move along. And times do change. But you make a good point. I think we are constantly speaking with referees about making sure that you referee that game to the last buzzer.
Bob, what's it like when you were in the golden era, my opinion and yours, I'm sure, is of NBA players. The late 80s, the 90s, the early 2000s, basketball was physical, it was tough, but the players played. They competed. Guys like Jordan, they played 82 games in a year. What was it like to ref games with Michael Jordan, Shaq, Bird, people like that, you know, just the best of the best, Kobe?
Yeah, I was very fortunate. I came in, my first year was Julius Erving's last year, so I got to referee
wow.
Julius,
Dr.
and then Larry and Magic, and into the Bad Boys, and then to Michael, and all the way up to LeBron and Steph. Steph came in, I was 2 years on the floor with him, refereed his dad, Dell, who was a
yep.
heck of a shooter, had
great
to come
shooter.
Off a screen to get his shot where the kid could just come over half court. But, you know, it was just an amazing players. And you said, Brent, we talk about it all the time as referees. You know, when you think back to that era of you had Patrick Ewing, you had David Robinson, you know, everything was post-play, trying to get the ball in and working.
Elijah Wan.
And just phenomenal, phenomenal players. And when I see those guys today, I always say it was an honor to work the games, and it truly was. The game is so fast and so beautiful when you think back to that era, that 3-on-2 break, that 2-on-1 break that went to the hoop instead of a kick out for a three,
right.
which, you know, is hard for us old dudes to understand because the beauty of the game was the fluidity of the poetry in motion and how Magic would lead that fast break. And, you know, it's Showtime with the Lakers. So all of that, it's part of our history, and everything changes in life. The spread game that has come into the game created a change for us as referees. We had a change because the real estate changed. Everybody was fighting to get that onto the box. So we were figuring out ways to best get angles for that. And then when the spread game came, we were getting caught. We weren't in good vision angles, so we had to spread the referees out as well. So we adjust to what coaches and players do. And I will tell you this, we're always behind because they're innovative about the game. We are reactive to the game. And
sure.
they are constantly figuring out ways to make the game and how do we take the rules and we get them right to the edge. And we're trying to figure out how do we keep them within those rules.
You know, you mentioned some of the superstars that you had the honor of refereeing. There is a thing in the NBA, you know, superstar calls. Superstar seems to be able to get away with a lot more. You know, they get somewhat of an advantage. And logic would dictate that, well, if you're a superstar, you don't need as many free throws as a guy who's coming off the bench, right? Why do superstars get a favorable whistle from the referee that other players, especially like rookies, don't get afforded any whistle at all?
Yeah, I tell folks that I wish I could bring them out onto an NBA floor and, you know, with what is being said about referees being able to do all this, we should leave the brains of NBA referees to scientists because people give us a lot more credit than we should have. It's like 10 guys in a blender out there. They're just freaking going and going and going. And it's not until you're able to get your eyes adjusted to be able to referee them, do you get better at seeing what they're doing. The superstars have the ball in their hands probably 80% more than any other player on the floor. So the reality is you're not going to make it. You can't get every call. It's too fast. It's going. Think about Michael Jordan. We did not call travels on him when he would go into the post and he'd do that spin move to the baseline and come up underneath or come up strong hand. The reason we were missing it, we didn't see that movement because we were refereeing the defense so much. Isaiah Thomas said to me one night, he just traveled. And he said, do you get his pivot foot as soon as he touches the ball? He said, because I do. And it was a reminder to me as a referee that Isaiah as a defender is getting the pivot foot because he's going to shade one way or the other. He's going to force the guy. And so you learn from players. Mm-hmm. You also learn from coaches. When you're on the floor, I tell referees all the time, you have to be able to determine whether it's an emotional response or is that coach telling you something. Because there are doctorates in the game of basketball along that sidelines. And at times, they are telling you things. They are seeing things that maybe you're not seeing. And you've got to bring all that intelligence information in so that you can best referee the game.
You know, Bob, one of the things I remember listening to one of your supervisors while you were still officiating, and he would say, if Pat Riley, Phil Jackson, Chuck Daly question or stand up and tell you something, listen to them because they're probably right because the rest of the time they're sitting down coaching. And I thought that was, you know, where there's other guys that I work for, UB, Fratello, that they bitched on every play. You know, there was never Brian Hill, all my guys from Jersey, but every play they reacted to, you know, and the referees were always wrong. And where Chuck would rarely say anything, even if a call was missed.
Exactly.
He would just understand. I thought that was really, you know, because it's like crying wolf all the time. You can't do it. And plus, I'm distracting you by screaming at you all the time, and you can't referee, right?
Yeah, I would, you know, later in my career, when you become more secure in your position, right? In any position you have in life, early on, you want to prove that you're right. All right. So you would bow your neck and try. And then at times you come to be more secure in your position. You would actually say to Brendan, I kicked the play. And that would end the conversation.
Right.
If you now bow your neck and try to prove that I'm right, the referee has to be able to admit. And at times, you know, you missed the play or that you didn't get it. When you're honest with a coach, it calms the water, but it also puts you all in a credibility and a believability and a trust level with each other. And those are three elements that are important for referees. You start off just being believable. Do you look like a referee? Do you handle yourself? Do you walk? And then there's a credibility by doing it night in and night out. And then it comes to trust. They trust you. They trust you with the game. And when you get to that level, all of a sudden there's a calmness that comes over that game. And you can still miss a call and they're not going to think, okay, this game's going in the toilet. I mean, right away they understand, okay, it's one missed call. It doesn't mean the biggest problem that in officiating is that in the last 2 to 3 minutes of a game, if I make a incorrect call early in a game, they have plenty of time to recover from that. In the last 2 to 3 minutes, when an incorrect call or a non-call incorrect is made, they don't have time to recover. And that's where you really got to heighten your abilities and your awareness and your focus. And I think at times what happens is it paralyzes referees because they don't want to make a call that they think could be interpreted as causing one team to win or the other. So they're slower. So our hope is to continually give them that calm confidence and say, continue to react to plays in the same way that you do during the first periods of the game as you do in the last.
You know, as Coach alluded to, some of the NBA coaches go crazy. I saw Eric Spoelstra a little while ago, and one of the funniest things I heard is, you know, the referee's made a wrong call, and he's screaming at the referee, but he's not talking smack. He said to the referee, he goes, focus. This is important. You need to focus. So Bob, what's one of the funnier things that a coach or a player has said to you while you're out there on the court?
Well, there's so many. I mean, I walked down on the floor. You know my background. For those in your audience, I was a New Jersey State Trooper, as Brendan alluded to. I went undercover for 3 years, infiltrated a traditional organized crime, the Mafia, La Cosa Nostra, whatever term you want to give to it. I walked out onto the floor one night, and Grant Hill was in street clothes. He wasn't playing for the Orlando Magic. He came over and he patted me down. He asked if I was wired. And and I said, yeah, I am, for ABC, but not for any other reason. But go back.
That's good.
Go back to early days when I started breaking into this business. And I was refereeing in the Jersey Shore League. And a guy by the name Eddie Donovan was the general manager of the New York Knicks. And he was a St. Bonaventure guy. And Eddie saw me working there, and he came up to me and he said, I'm going to give your name to Mike Saunders. I'd like you to work the scrimmages for the Knicks. They play at Monmouth College as they get ready for the season. UV was the coach, Patino, Adubato, those guys were his assistants. And so when I got that opportunity, I would go. The scrimmage was only 15, 20 minutes as they were in the preseason training. I'd get there early, and I'd sit there and listen to UV. Because now you're getting to listen to those folks that have the doctorates that are going to pay dividends in my career. And I remember walking in one fall day, and I had like a sweater over my golf shirt, a pair of slacks, and I'm walking in with my referee bag early. And Yubi was coaching Patrick Ewing's like in his rookie year. And as he's speaking to the team, he sees me come in and he says, hey, Delaney, you belong over at Princeton with the Nets dressed like that. You're a preppy. And so the team laughs. I walk to the locker room. I get to him. The next day, I went to do another scrimmage. I walked into Monmouth, and Yubi's back was to me as he was talking to the team, and the players could see me walking, and you could see their head going up. I was in my full state police uniform with my gun, everything. And I walked up and I said, Coach, you have a problem with the way I'm dressed today? Without missing a beat, UB said, no, sir, trooper, have a good day. But those are the kinds of interactions that are important. Yeah. And then I got to go over to Bobby McKinnon's and work his scrimmages for the Nets. Then down to St. Joe's for Matty Gukas. All of that was training ground for me, an opportunity that most people don't get to be around and have these conversations. I have conversations with Brendan after games because we had relationships.
Right.
It wasn't personal. It was trying, all of us were trying to get better. He would ask me about rules, about this. And I'd ask him about what were they trying to do with that back screen. So I had an understanding of what's taking place. That kind of education for a referee is vital.
Let's talk a little bit about what you mentioned there, going undercover with the Mafia, with the mob, or however you want to describe it. How did that all come about, and what was that experience like? Because going undercover, you're essentially acting a character for, what was it, 3 years that you did undercover. I know it's not really a basketball question, but it's fascinating to me. I do like the occasional Mafia movie, so that's as close as I get to it, but you went there and lived it. So talk to us about that.
Yeah, I was a state trooper, and back then we lived at the stations. We were 2 days on, 2 days off. I graduated from the State Police Training Academy in Seaguard, New Jersey, and I was at my third station. They transferred you every 6 months, and I was at my third station, and I was active in arrests, and I had developed somewhat of a reputation of doing a lot of criminal work. And I got a call to call Lieutenant. I walked into the station. They try to make you feel good about yourself. They have this little cubby hole with your name on it in the squad room, like you have your own office, but it's like being back in kindergarten with these cubbies. And this note said, call Lieutenant Jack Liddy, Division Headquarters, Criminal Investigation Section, Organized Crime Bureau. This guy had more titles next to his name than I ever saw. And Mo, I grew up Irish Catholic. That means I wake up guilty in the morning. I thought I did something wrong. I thought I had a problem on my hands. And I called, and the lieutenant said, you're going to be in for a while. And each state police station had a kitchen in an area that the public wouldn't see, which was our hangout area. He said, I'll meet you in the kitchen about an hour and a half. Hour and a half later, I walk in. There's this intimidating figure. Lieutenant Liddy stands about 6'4". He's got meat hooks for hands, hangs on his lapels, when he speaks to you. He's also the guy that, you know, the button has never met the hole on his shirt. He's wearing a 16 when it should be a 22. And we have a conversation. And then he says to me, are you interested in doing undercover work? He said, yes, sir. He turned and walked away. I'm thinking drugs, because back then all we're doing is buy bust on the street. He turns and walks away. I said, Lieutenant, what is it? Narcotics? Drugs? He said, you keep asking questions, you're going to be out of running. Over the next 3 weeks, I learned that the President's Organized Crime Task Force out of Washington, D.C., the FBI and New Jersey State Police were joining forces, and we were going to start our own trucking company on the waterfront in New Jersey. I became one of those undercover guys, another state trooper, three FBI agents. And then from there, we developed a larger trucking company that I became the president of, in the shadows of the Statue of Liberty, in the shadows of the Statue of Liberty, in Liberty State Park in Jersey City. And we had two new partners, the Genovese and Bruno crime families. We're kicking back 25%. To go into the whole story, there was an informant involved that opened doors for us. If you saw the movie, The Irishman, I paid most of those guys some money at some point. Johnny Keith, Simone, Roy Stocker. I mean, a lot of mob guys that are well known were people that I interacted with. To answer your question, what is it like? At first, it's exhilarating and you're excited and you think it's cool. And then by the second year and by the third year, you just want out of it. I dealt with post-traumatic stress afterwards. Basketball became my therapy. I couldn't play anymore, so I started officiating little kids' games. There was something about this game that is therapeutic for all of us. And it's the only game that you can go by yourself and play. You can't play baseball by yourself, can't play football by yourself. You can play basketball by yourself, or you can play with one other person. There's therapy that's taking place on a basketball court. And it was therapeutic for me. It gave me an inner peace. There is nothing more satisfying than between those lines. And people say getting yelled at and screamed at by NBA players, that's inner peace. For me, it was. It was an amazing experience. And it opened a door for a career in the National Basketball Association.
So to follow with that, Mo, when Bob comes into the league, the Bad Boys, the Pistons, are playing. He's first time he's working our game. And Chuck Daly and I, before the game, do a 2-minute scout on the officials that are working that night. Certain officials, we would say, don't say a word to this guy. He doesn't like us. He'll tee you up. He doesn't like you. Other guys, Jack Madden, Bob, different guys, they would let you play the way the game was supposed to be played. Mike Mathis, et cetera, you know, the whole deal. So all of a sudden, we're doing this thing. I said, listen, there's a new guy tonight. Don't say shit to this guy, okay? He is tougher than each one of you guys. And let me say, I've known this guy since college. Don't mess with him, all right? He's not going to take no shit from you guys. So my friend Rick Mahorn, who I've known since he was in seventh grade, is my enforcer. He's standing on the foul line. Bob's administering a free throw, standing next to Rick. And Rick is... He's a warrior, and he's a very nice guy too. And he stands next to Bob and says, "Seem like a good guy. Welcome to the league." Bob doesn't even respond to him, and he says, "I can't believe that Brendan said you're an effing pussy." and all I can see is Bob looking like, "What the heck?" And Bob, of course, doesn't hit him with a T because he's not saying it. He's saying that I said it. And the game goes on, and he's just giving me dirty looks the whole game. And then afterwards, I wait for him after the game as he's leaving. I said, "What's going on?" He said, "What are you telling the players? I'm a blankety blank." I said, "I would never say that." And he said, and at that point, he knew how playful and how smart these guys were. And they wanted to see how he reacted. But every time Bob was on a game that the Pistons had, our guys never questioned anything because they knew they were getting a fair shot. And that's all you want out of an official. And he had the ability to defuse. We put officials in a lot of bad situations the way we played, and he was able to defuse them all. And his way of doing it is really the way you should, you know, you can handle anything. Forget basketball, just business and stuff. And that's why his skill set is so incredible and why he's just flourishing now outside of basketball.
Well, thanks, Brian. I remember a game at the, if you remember, the entire team came to captain's meeting. It was like the Crips and the Bloods were going to play that night. For some reason, you go to the Kappas, right? Jess Kersey's the crew chief. I'm working, and it's Mike Lauerman. And Mike goes to get the visiting team, and I forget who they were. Maybe it was Indiana. And I go to get Detroit. Now, Detroit, the entire team starts walking with me. I go, wait a minute. Who's the captain there? It's Billy Lambeer, or it was Isaiah. I forget who it was. And we're all Kappas. And so they come up. So now the other two, the rest of the, everybody's up there. And now I've got to like go into my state police barking voices about get this thing under control because people are bouncing basketballs. Nobody's listening to what's going on. They're lined up like they're going to go to battle with each other. It's just like these are the kinds of things that you cannot plan for that you better be able to respond to. Players will do things in games. Situations will happen. If you go right to the technical foul as your only way of handling that situation, there's nothing good going to come out of that. Yeah. I mean, that's not the way to handle a situation. That's the last resort. Talk to people. Figure out a way. You can freaking calm the waters down. Figure out how you can get players to kind of like, and there's always somebody on the team that is the leader of that team that you can go to. I need your help. I need your help. Can you get this guy under control? Can you? Dennis Rodman. You always needed help with Dennis, right? You needed somebody else on his team to help. When he was with Chuck and Brendan, first time I refereed, that he wouldn't say a word. I mean, he was calm. But as time went on and he went to a different, then he went to San Antonio and then he was with Chicago, he was a challenge every night. You had to be ready to be able to diffuse and keep him. Same thing with Ron Artest. I would always be talking to him. I would, how's everything going, Ron? I wanted him to know I was paying attention. And there are small ways that you can have ways to be able to keep that game at an even kill.
Go ahead, Mo.
The most iconic picture, if any of you guys are listening, if you type Bob Delaney into Google, the first thing you'll see is a picture of Michael Jordan enraged, screaming in Bob's face, and Bob is just looking at him just like, whatever. Do you remember that conversation that iconic photo is from and what was being said?
Yeah, I do. It was a game that was in Atlanta. And if you recall, Atlanta used to have the Super Sports Show weekend that would take place in iconic players representing different shoes or gear would come to watch the game. And the NBA would send Chicago in to play Atlanta that weekend. And it was like you're at a finals game. I mean, it was press everywhere. Michael goes up for a shot late in the game. It was probably about a 3-second time difference on the clock. They're up by two. Stevie Smith's got a hand on his hip. Michael misses the shot. Leitner gets the rebound. Atlanta calls timeout. They're going to advance. They got a shot with a three to win the game. And as I go to give the timeout, I can sense that Michael's coming around along my side. And he starts out the conversation by saying, you know, I got hit on a play. I said, I don't think you got hit, Mike. He said, Stevie pushed me on my hip. I said, I don't see any extension of elbow to wrist. Elbow to wrist is a big in the NBA because you can tell a lot from a player. So you have to have an awareness of the player, but there's also areas of the body. That elbow to wrist didn't come out. I just saw it as a crook, and it was on his hip. And I said, we went back and forth and discussed it. And Michael said, you think I'm going to miss that shot? I said, well, if you're the man, why don't you make the shot? The dumbest thing I've ever said in my life. Dumbest thing I've ever said in my life. And then the conversation got more heated. But I can't give a technical. I just said I put the fuel on the fire. I'm the one that was not right in that situation. And so it goes back and forth. Then the ball's inbounded. I think Leitner takes a three. They miss it. Chicago wins. Fast forward 20 years. Up at Lake Tahoe. And you always know a golf tournament is low on celebrities when I get invited. And I happened to be up there. And I walked out and I wore knickers because that was what Payne Stewart, where I was friends with him. And I walked out.
You wore what?
Payne Stewart. Knickers. Plus four.
Scottish Knickers.
Yeah, I can remember who I'm speaking to.
You know,
with.
in England, that's women's underwear. So could you just clarify what you mean by that? Because
plus fours.
Okay, okay.
Plus fours.
Because we're sick. I'm like, I don't know what you're really trying to say here, Bob.
Mo, I told you before we get on, you're the only guy that speaks perfect English. You got two guys in New Jersey. You're the only one that speaks perfect English.
I'm thinking, Bob's into some crazy stuff. I know what's going on.
And Charles Barkley sees me, and Michael's practicing. And Charles says, "Hey, Mike, look at Tinkerbell's here." And Michael turns around. This is 20 years later. He says, you missed that play in Atlanta. Let it go, dude. They never forget the plays that
they
you
never
missed.
Forget. 100%.
Coaches, players never forget a play that cost them a game or cost them a situation or put them in a bad spot. And they will remind you forever, every time you see them.
Bob, we had that. I loved it. We had these iconic referees. They were stars. Earl Strom, Bavetta in his own way.
Yes.
But there was Mike Mathis, as we mentioned. There were personalities. And I remember being in the finals in L.A., and here comes Earl Strom, runs into our huddle. We're in a timeout. He runs into our huddle and now starts screaming at Chuck and knock that shit off, you guys. And Chuck says, get the F out of here. And Earl just turns and walks out. I mean, but they were so good. Their personalities were so strong. And I think it made the game great. I really do.
Brendan, I was so fortunate because those were guys. Daryl Garretson was an amazing,
fabulous
teacher of the game for all of us. Danny Crawford, myself, Joey Crawford, Steve Giavi, all those guys, we came up under Hugh Evans, was a great mentor for me. Jess Kersey, one of them had a way to be able to, that you could take something from them and learn to put it into your own personality. Not try to be them, but take and learn from them so that you could bring that out to the floor with your experience level. It was just amazing. Hugh Evans was I'll tell you, Hugh Evans one day, two man, we're working a game, and after the game, we stopped for a drink, and he says to me, tell me about flagrant fouls, young fella. It was my rookie year. It's not quoting the rule book. He said, no. You played the game. You know the game. He said, you know how you tell a flagrant one? If you're on the floor and you say to yourself, that's bullshit, that's a flagrant one. But if you say to yourself, that's effing bullshit, that's a flagrant two. And you know what? Those all kinds of theories work because you know what belongs on a basketball court and what does not belong on a basketball
court. That is phenomenal.
Yeah, the human element is so important when it comes into refereeing, right? So now we have the video reviews and they go and they spend 10 minutes looking at the thing in New Jersey. And I think, you know, part of me thinks it's great because you're getting, I guess, the right call 99% of the time now. However, the human part of me, you know, from playing basketball and stuff, is just like, man, just make the call and let's get on with the game and so on and so forth, right? But the question I have is, with a player like Draymond Green, for example, who's the hot topic amongst foul calls, and you mentioned flagrant fouls, that's why Draymond springs to mind. He seems to get away with so much more than anyone else ever. From my perspective, it's just, well, that's who Draymond is. We can't just eject him every game, and we can't foul him out in the first quarter every game, so we're going to let him be physical. The same way, like this season, the Oklahoma City Thunder defense is so much more physical, and they're allowed to get away with more stuff. How much does the identity of a team or a player before the game even begins factor into how that game is called?
Well, what you want to be able to do is to call the games in a consistent manner. And everybody calls for consistency, but the reality is that you have to have calibration in order to have consistency. So meaning referees have to have a like mindset. And the way I describe it is that if in your home that your clocks are 10 minutes off, your family can function. But if they're an hour and a half off, you're calling for folks to be to dinner at 5 o'clock, and so it's not going to be disruptive. Another analogy I use is a six-lane highway. The better games, when we have a six-lane highway and referees are calling plays all over that six-lane highway, coaches can't coach, players can't play, it becomes disruptive. Fans become upset. Mm. But if we can narrow it down to 2.5 lanes with a like mindset of understanding what a foul is, what illegal actions are, what legal actions are, and what gray area is, and we keep it in that 2.5 lane highway, players can play, coaches can coach, and fans see a better game.
Mo, to talk about Draymond, he's a Michigan kid, Saginaw, Michigan. So when I talk to Isaiah or Dumars or the guys about Draymond, we love Draymond because he's one of the few guys in the league that we would have let be on the Pistons, right? Yep. You know, we would have, he could be on there. But if we played against him, he wouldn't have lasted one quarter in any game. Our guys would have gotten him ejected just like that, you know, by just a little hit. And they knew how to, they would know how to provoke him. And that's where the really smart guys, the people in the league don't provoke him to get him to go the extra step, you know, where they're just letting him do his thing. But the really good older type of players, I think, really would have taken advantage of him. And he would have had to adjust because he's very smart.
Yeah, to that point, Brent, and you go back into the eras that we were there, players policed themselves. If somebody did something, you knew there was going to be a shot coming down. I think it was a game that I had in Utah, and Karl Malone took a shot. I think it was at Isaiah. And it was a flagrant foul like within the first 8 seconds of the game because it was payback for something that happened in a game prior. And so those are, that's an awareness that you have to be on top of that, not overreact, not underreact. When we meet the challenge of the game, and I use my hands to make the point, when we meet the challenge of the game, we bring the game back under control. When we overreact or underreact, we cause for that game to get bumpy, and that causes for problems. And that's a referee's responsibility and an expectation. Meet the challenge of the game because challenges are coming.
For our listeners that had Isaiah, we had Isaiah on here. The payback was Isaiah was not picked for the Dream Team, not by the by Chuck, by a 12-man committee. They thought that Magic and Jordan wouldn't play, which was bullshit. So they didn't pick him. They picked John Stockton, who was a great player, but wasn't as good as Isaiah. Fairness. And Stockton knows he's not as good as Isaiah. So we play in the Palace a week or two prior. It's in November. Isaiah goes for 44. And Rodman and I get ejected from the game. In the second half, we win the game. Now we go back to Utah. First drive of the game.
Why did they eject you, coach? Why did they eject you?
Because they called an offensive foul on Rodman that was BS. Stockton hit him in the groin. And so they called an offensive foul on Rodman. And the next thing I know, they hit Rodman with two tees. And I went to the official at when he was doing that, and I said, that is effing BS. And I got thrown too, which was accurate. They should have done that. And boy, Rodman and I in the locker room, and I'm saying, we better not. We had a double-digit lead. I said, we better win this game. I don't want to be in that locker room. And we did. But then the first play of the game out in Utah, Karl Malone took him out. Karl Malone took him out, 40 stitches in his head. Bob had the game.
Go ahead, Bob.
You asked why Brendan is ejected. As you know, you can hear his New Jersey voice. He goes home and watches TFMV. he uses that adjective everywhere.
I thought I know it. It's funny though how much the game has changed. Did either of you guys see the Sixers? Who was it? The Sixers Magic game last night, right?
I did. Yes.
Did you see what social media described as a fight? And it was the most pathetic thing I've ever seen. It's like Andre Drummond and Wendell Carter kind of pushing each other just a little bit. Ref blows a whistle for a foul. Andre Drummond squares up, puts both of his fists up, and Wendell Carter just looks at him and he just says, go on then, do it. Do it then. All the players are like kind of shouting each other, pushing each other. Jalen Suggs got ejected and so on and so forth. And I'm just watching it just like, this is so pathetic because none of these guys are going to do a single thing to the other ones. Like maybe a little push at most.
Bobby, if you didn't see it, they described Andre Drummond, who is just a massive guy, as getting in the Irish leprechaun stance like this.
You know how that leprechaun does it in the football games. But that's all he did. He just went like this. It was hysterical, I thought.
But it's fascinating that the game has become so much less physical in that regard. Bob, from your side, because you were with the league for so long, is there directions from the league to kind of stamp all of this out and, you know, trying to make it a family-friendly product and so on and so forth? Can you speak to that extent of what the league's tried to do and clean up their image?
Yeah, if you think back to when I came in the league, there were fights almost every night. It was something taking place. And when I mean a fight, it was throwing hands. And guys knew who the guys who could punch. They knew Isaiah could throw a punch. They knew that Xavier McDaniel could throw a punch. And so there were certain guys that they wouldn't really want to mess with, because when you really think of an NBA fight, they're roundhouse kind of throws. And, you know, as a boxer, you know that you got to hit.
Yeah.
And so it's more of a scrum. But the size of the men that are on that floor, I mean, the potential for real dangerous situations can erupt. I think that the attraction of the NBA to me was my law enforcement background. And I'm not being funny about it, is that I could see things bubbling up before they were starting to take place and could intercede or come to where. So that was an attraction of what we would call game management back then. And then the more that the game went on and the game became managed from 645 Fifth Avenue, which is the headquarters of the NBA, it was after that San Antonio game where somebody came off a bench in the playoffs and they were. And so teams started assigning coaches to make sure that no one came off the bench. So it made it easier to deal with, because you're only dealing with the 10 players at the time versus what's coming at you. And now today, you know, with the amount of fines and people, Timmy McCormick, remember Timmy? McCormick played, I think he's one of the president or vice president of the Players Association, played for Houston. I gave him a technical one time and I think ejected he and whoever he was fighting with. And next time I saw him, he said, "Bah, I'll never do that again." I said, "Good." He said, "No." He says, "When my wife saw the fine that I got, I heard it every day. Every time she wanted like something new in the house, she said, 'Well, if you didn't get in that fight and get that fine.'" So, you know, there's a lot of ways that you're able to control situations.
Right.
League also, you know, because back then, you know, you're talking about Michael Jordan and his travel and his pivot going to the baseline. But back then, you know, players couldn't put their hand under the ball. You know, it always makes me laugh when people say, "This is the most skilled generation ever." And I look at it and I'm like, well, 20, 30, 40 years ago, if you put your hand even to the side of the ball, they're calling you for a carry. Now you can damn near carry the ball for 3 steps and then carry on dribbling. So did the league also give directions, and do the league also give directions for things like that? Because, you know, for a lot of people, they look at it as, you know, the NBA wants to make the game more offensive friendly, create more highlights, more fans tune in, so on and so forth. So the defense is at a real disadvantage now. Is that direction from the league, or is this just a natural evolution of the game?
I was never directed to call anything other than by the rules. I mean that from the bottom of my heart. That I have never been told about this guy is a superstar and you don't do that. None of that, you know, all of those kinds of conspiracy theories do not exist. But I'll go back to what I said earlier. Do I think that there's some bias that takes place? Or do I think there's some insecurity when I was a younger referee that I didn't know if I saw that or I didn't? So that spin move that we talk about, Michael, he was picking up his pivot foot as he made the spin move. It wasn't until we watched video. And that's where I said, like earlier, coaches and players are innovative. They will remember the skip step? You jump off the same. We couldn't get that. It was happening so quick. It's a travel, but we didn't get that. I finally got one in Indiana. I'm trying to prove that I got it. I almost fell on the floor trying to show the skip. I don't have the athleticism. So we have to get, we become better when we watch video. The same way that players and coaches watch video, referees have to live with the video. And you have to, that's the only way you're going to be able to train your mind to be able to see it. Mo, one of the other things that I did early on, we had little 8mm kind of video recorders that the league gave us so we could watch games. And I would watch it in fast forward because you can watch all basketball and there's always a level that's higher that you can watch that can speed up your eyes. I'm going to a game in Phoenix. I'm sitting on the plane. Behind me is Craig Sager, God rest his soul. And I'm watching it fast forward. He comes up to me and says, "What are you doing?" He says, "That game." He said, "I'm trying to quicken my eyes. If I can see something on this video, that when I see it on the floor, it'll look slower to me and I have more times to make the decision." So I was constantly doing it. He actually did a little story on TNT back in that time frame. He got hold of a doctor and said, "Is this possible?" And the doctor said, "Yes, you can train your eyes the same way you can build a muscle." So these are all areas that we work on with officials. Being able to see big. I ask officials 15 minutes a day. When you're sitting in your room, you should be able to see the front wall, the ceiling, and the two side walls. That's your peripheral vision. And how are you seeing big? So you see that screen coming when you're refereeing the guard play, so that you see what's going on the floor. That's our responsibility as a team, to build our physical abilities better to be able to officiate the game.
And with those physical abilities, I've always been fascinated by this, right? And I'll ask this question respectfully, right? Some of the referees, well, not so much nowadays because a lot of the referees are younger, but when I was growing up, I'd watch the NBA. Some of the referees were significantly older than the players, but they don't get substitutes and they're running up and down the floor the same way the players. What level of conditioning do you have to be in to be an NBA referee?
High level. You're constantly working out. When I first came in, you would get yourself into shape as the season went on, right? I mean, it was a reality to it. And then physical fitness became a priority and everybody was fit. And then we got to the point that it was too much. Everybody's wearing this, you know, trying to get their arms looking real big in the uniforms. And it got a little bit silly for a while. This is about being able to run with the greatest athletes on the planet and being able to be in a position to be able to stay with them. That's when you realize, as you start to get older, I can't get to spots. I always say, when you get really good at this, you can't referee anymore because you can't run. So this is a process that takes place during your career. You've got to run in the off season. You give yourself a little time off after the season ends, but it's a constant, because if you let yourself go physically, you're not going to be able to catch up. This is there's such a pride in doing what we do. Coaches are proud of what they do. Players are proud of what they do. Referees are proud of what we do and are part of the game. And as I said to you guys earlier, there's only three groups of people that get to put their feet on the floor. And that's coaches, players, and referees. And that gives you an amazing insight into the game. And being on that floor, you better be physically fit. Because if you're not, we know that when someone gets tired, they make poor decisions. And so it's not only physical fitness. We've now graduated to say we have to have mental fitness, emotional fitness. All of those are parts of what make a total official in any sport.
Absolutely. I was just going to say, I was in, where was I? I was somewhere on the road working at my hotel gym. And do you know James Williams?
Yeah.
The NBA referee.
Yes.
Well, the fans at home will know him as the referee who looks like Gucci Mane.
Yeah. Gucci's his nickname.
Yeah, he comes into the gym and you know, he's working out next to me. And like, I think I'm in all right shape. But the workout this guy did, I was like, what the hell? Is the referees on steroids? What's going on here? This guy was an animal. So, you know, it's always fascinating to see like the referees going nonstop the whole game. So, yeah,
there's
sorry.
There's two Coach, workouts, continue. Right? There's the workout that you do on the day off, and there's a workout that you do the day that you're working. Because you don't want to burn yourself out with a strong workout because you need your legs for that whole game. You have to have an awareness of what is your schedule and what is going on. I ran in water for years in the off season because I didn't want to pound my knees and my back. And so I had a vest that I would go in the deep end of the water and mimic running. And that was a way to stay in the cardiovascular shape. And so these are all parts of what our business is. And all too often people think we just fly in, mess up a game, and then go home. There's a lot more to this.
The great Earl Strom, when they were doing the testing, they had different runs that you guys had to make before the season. There was a wonderful young referee, Mike Lauerman, and Earl was in his 60s, and Mike, I think, won there either the mile run or whatever, mile and a half. He won the thing, and Earl would say to a group of coaches, he would say at the summer league, he'd say, all that means is that he's going to get down the court quicker to blow the effing call. I'll get there. I'll get it right. You know, but that was the old time and Philadelphia mentality, which they were a whole different breed of referees. All the guys out of Philly. Bob, one of the things
referee,
that
now that you say it, Jake O'Donnell. I mean, a great referee.
Loved him. Loved great Jake. Referee. He was one of our favorites.
Eddie Rush, great referee, Philadelphia guy.
Yep. You know, one of the things that you know, I'm most proud of you about, besides your officiating, is the things that you've done post officiating, and you know, your stuff with NBA Cares, but mainly you do so much with our veterans in the U.S. Servicemen and PTSD, which was a big part of your life, as you stated in the beginning. Talk to us a little bit about that and how it affects all of society.
It affects all of society. And with that said, those who serve are in the higher risk group for post-traumatic stress because they go to where trauma is. And so I started speaking before I was an NBA referee and I was coming out of the undercover work. I started talking more and more about what I was experiencing and I became a student of it. I wanted to understand it to the highest level that I could of what was going on inside of me because I had emotional violence inside of me. I didn't know what was going on. You know, Springsteen's got a song called Better Days, and it says there's a line in it that says, it's a sad man, my friend, who's living in his own skin and can't stand the company. That was me. I didn't like who I was. I didn't like what was going on. I didn't know why this anger was inside of me. I didn't know why this fear that I was living under, that the mob guys were coming to get me. It was not a comfortable time in my life. And basketball gave me that inner peace. But I came to a realization that what is personal is universal. If it's happening to me, it's happening to someone else. And so I became a student of it. The military heard about the work that I was doing with law enforcement. And General Odierno, General Dempsey, General Cullen, Admiral McRaven, they embraced my message. And I would say to them, my boots are not my boots. My boots are not their boots, but I have to go where their boots go. So I would go to Iraq and Afghanistan and spend times embedded with troops to share my story, to allow them to connect the dots to their story. I've been to almost every military base throughout the United States, Asia, and Europe. As I said, Iraq and Afghanistan during the wars on multiple times. Special Operations Command under General Fenton, who just retired. I spent a lot of time at MacDill Air Force Base. It's an honor for me. And it's something that, you know, when I went through that undercover job, and if you would ask me if I would do it again right after I experienced that, I would say no. And yet, it opened a door for me to get to the NBA because basketball became my therapy. It gave me an opportunity to have a platform of having NBA Cares supporting the work that I was doing. And it started to broaden and it went to firefighters and it went to healthcare workers and it goes to, because we're all susceptible to this. But to be around our troops and to spend time with them and their families is such an honor. And they see what the rest of the world does not. And they experience this. And, you know, I'll just give you one quick story. It's not unusual for them to say to me, sir, I can't go over a bridge. I'm late every place I go because I'm checking for IEDs. They don't tell anybody that because they're embarrassed. Sir, I hate garbage day in my town because along the street, that's where IEDs could be hidden. Sir, I was tasked with taking care of the enemy while I was there, and I'm coming home speaking to my family like they're the enemy. Where, sir, I went for a walk with my kids. I've been away so long, I wanted to bond with them, but my kid kicked a can, and I feel this big because I yelled and screamed at him. But where I came from, if you kick something, you're not coming home. I didn't make these stories up. These are stories they share with me. they're living with some of this stuff, helping them. We have a tremendous debt in the United States, and we hear about it on a daily basis, the national debt. I believe we have a larger debt to the men and women who serve us. And so any way that I can be of help, that's a platform that has taken. I went through and putting through the way those bad guys, and that was the responsibility that I had. But I now come to realize I had to go through that to be in a position today to be able to help a lot of good people understand what they're experiencing.
Wow.
So it's a tremendous honor. Thanks, Brendan, for bringing that up.
Bob, you know, I'm so we've known each other 50 years, Mo, and he's one of my dearest friends because he's the real deal. And I'm calling Netflix after the show.
Oh, 100%. I was just about to say, this is a movie you're describing.
No,
but do you know what's the most insane part for me? Is, you know, you went undercover with the mob, and you know, you're talking about your experience, and now you're living in a state where, you know, I saw a video about you, and you said you were checking behind a shower curtain every time to see if someone was hiding there. And then you go and pick a job where you're on national television at least like 82 times a year. I'm like, this guy got balls of steel. Because your schedule is just out publicly. They know what city you're going to be in. They know where you're going to be. So credit to you for overcoming everything you've been and then going on to help people with what you're doing. It's a real, real inspiration. So we appreciate you coming on the show, Bob. And we appreciate everything you do to go and help others, because that is the most important part.
Thanks, Mo. And I look forward to when I'm across the pond, sit and have a pint with you.
My man, you're welcome anytime. You just let me know when you're over here. And
good to see you, man.
Love you, Bob. Thank you so much.
Yes, sir. We appreciate you taking the time. And, you know, if people want to hear more of your story, I believe you have a book that they can purchase.
Yeah, they can go to DelaneyConsultants.com. I have 3 books: Covert, My Years Infiltrating the Mobs, Surviving the Shadows, A Journey of Hope into Post-Traumatic Stress, and Heroes Are Human: Lessons and Resilience, and Courage and Wisdom from the COVID Frontlines. General Fenton introduced me as the only guy he knows who has written more books than he's read.
Bob is a proud graduate of the Harvard on the Hudson. Yes, he is.
Harvard on the Hudson.
Is.
There we go. Appreciate you, Bob. Appreciate you guys at home for tuning in. Make sure you subscribe to the show, YouTube, Spotify, Apple, wherever you get your podcast from. Check out the other work that Bob's doing. He's doing truly amazing stuff, and check out some of his books. And until next time, get buckets.